Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. A major federal report is warning that climate change could reduce the size of the U.S. economy by about 10% by the end of the century. The report, released last week, comes just a month after the United Nations predicted that the world could face a climate crisis by 2040. Environmental writer Elizabeth Rush says that might sound far from now, but many Americans are already living with some of the devastating effects of climate change. Rush spent 5 years exploring America's coastlines, which she details in her book titled Rising: Dispatches from the New American Shore. When we spoke, I asked her what first inspired her to investigate sea level rise as a book topic.
I was teaching at the College of Staten Island when Hurricane Sandy washed ashore in 2012, and Staten Island was profoundly impacted by this storm. Our college campus remained closed for a number of weeks, and when we reopened, many of my students were missing. They had been, you know, displaced by the storm, and then were living in temporary FEMA housing or were living with friends and family, often in New Jersey. And most of the College of Staten Island students have part-time or full-time jobs on top of their studies. They had to make a series of really difficult decisions after Sandy. You know, do I continue to pursue my degree? Their university studies really took a back burner to some other more pressing issues. And that's when I started to realize that in this really subtle way, climate change and sea level rise in particular was already starting to dismantle some of our most vulnerable communities in this country. So I started to become profoundly interested in this question: who's feeling the early impacts of sea level rise? How is it changing their communities? And where do you go with that knowledge?
You know, I was going to ask you to read a little bit of your book, and it's actually from when you were writing about Staten Island, and you reflect a little bit on tidal marshes. I'm wondering if you could read that here.
Absolutely. For most of my life, I never gave tidal marshes much thought. But now they are, in their sly and unassuming way, absorbing my attention. To most, a wetland is just a mess of grass, the sulfuric scent of decomposition, miasmas, and mud. But I'm beginning to see them as divining rods, signaling where there will be more water in the future, and even more importantly, that the future is, in many cases, already here.
That's beautiful. You write so beautifully about this, so it's so different from other types of environmental writing, but I'm wondering, in the time that you spent, particularly in Staten Island, and you say that you learned that in many cases the future is already here, describe what that was like.
When I started writing about sea level rise, many of the early reports would talk about climate change as this future problem. And I think that we still very much do that today. Even more recently, the IPCC said, you know, we need to start talking about 2040, that we need to start talking about what are the severe early impacts of climate change that will manifest by 2040. But the reality is we're already seeing sea level rise in our coastal community. So when you look at a tidal marsh, that is a very low-lying ecosystem. So one thing that I started to notice in many of these tidal marshes all around the country is you're starting to see these marshes drowned. And I started to get really interested both in tidal marshes and the more than human communities that inhabit them, but also the human communities that live alongside of or on top of tidal marshes.
Right. You visit Maine, Rhode Island, Louisiana, Florida, California. And because we're primarily based in New England, tell our listeners what messages you took from the coast of Rhode Island.
So within, you know, the first week when I lived in Rhode Island, I biked out to the nearest tidal marsh that I could find close to Providence. And there I found something that I had started to notice in tidal marshes all around the country: a series of big coastal hardwood trees that had died because of saline inundation. And I started to become really obsessed with these trees and obsessed with this form because I think if you look at any tidal marsh, if you go to a tidal marsh that you know, or even that you pass by, you know, on your commute or that some part, peripheral part of your life, I will bet you money that you will find dead hardwood trees in that tidal marsh. And they're dying because of saline inundation, and they're dying because of higher tides and stronger storms. When their root system suck up an excess of salt water, that leads to the stunting of growth and the eventual death of that tree. And I think for many, climate change remains difficult to touch. But if we go to these coastal communities, if we go to these tidal marshes, and we start to look and pay attention to the species that have long lived there, we'll notice these big trees. They're hard to overlook. And you see them, and for me, they're really a marker that the world has already changed, that climate change is with us in the present tense.
In Boston, our mayor, Marty Walsh, has outlined the climate change plan, and it involves creating this system of waterfront parks, trying to restore marshes, and elevating infrastructure, basically. It's a very complicated plan, but I would say that those are probably the three main elements of it. Would you say that that is essentially what many cities should be thinking about right now?
Well, one of the places that I spent a lot of time was San Francisco and the San Francisco Bay Area, and they have the second largest wetlands rehabilitation project in the entire country, and they're restoring wetlands all around the coast in the San Francisco Bay Area. And a lot of those wetlands they're trying to restore at a slow grade, which means that they're trying to give those wetlands a chance to migrate up and in as well as sea levels rise. But the folks out in San Francisco will tell you, you know, these wetlands, even as we build them on these slow slopes so they can migrate up and in, all they're doing is buying us time. They're buying us time to understand the fact that we are going to have to move a lot of people. We're going to have to move a lot of low-lying infrastructure. And if we can, you know, create sort of a stopgap valve to give us 20, 30, 40 years to wrap our minds around that fact, then let's do that. And let's do that in a way that can create ecosystems for threatened and endangered species as well.
Right. You write about this sort of retreat from some coastal communities like Staten Island. So basically, retreat is unavoidable in your opinion.
Yes. I mean, I think retreat is unavoidable. I was just reading one of the latest publications in Nature, which is a leading, you know, scientific mm-hmm. journal, and they're finding that Antarctica is melting at rates 30 times faster than the low ball predictions that the International Panel on Climate Change predicts. So going back to those questions about Boston and its infrastructure, yes, we need to think about innovative infrastructure solutions, but ultimately they're going to buy us time. And the lowest lying places, the places that, you know, have long flooded, tidal marshes are flood-prone landscapes to begin with. Those are places that I think we are going to have to consider giving up. Mm. And some of Boston is built on fill, and some of Boston is built on tidal marsh.
Right. You talk about specific areas. Newbury Street, right? I mean, you know, different places like that. Like, what will happen? It will be dramatically changed because of climate change. But, of course, the big question is when. And you mentioned the United Nations climate change report and 2040, which was the date in that report as to when some immediate effects of climate change might be noticeable. Is that what you take away? Do you take away that date unless dramatic steps are taken to change things?
This morning I thought to myself, oh, that's 20 years. That hadn't really hit me. I think it still can feel sort of strange, abstract, a projection. Mm-hmm. Using that date, I think, produces a feeling of magical thinking that we're not actually in the middle of climate change now. You know, if you are a low-income person living atop a tidal marsh. Climate change is already real for you in the present tense.
Right. You know, I just want to ask something a little bit related to the UN report, because there was a study that came out shortly after that report about how climate change will affect the price of beer, right? It could triple in some countries. And the study's authors say, you know, that's not the biggest deal about climate change, but it might make people more concerned about climate change. I mean, because they are these projections of 20 years away, maybe at the most alarming, if you will. You know, what do you do to get people concerned about this as a problem? What do you do to get attention to this?
That question was very much in my mind while I was writing Rising. I felt like the climate change reporting that I was seeing was sort of the repetition of a series of statistical anomalies, you know, record-breaking heat waves, record-breaking storms, record-breaking rain, every year smashing the previous year's record-breaking record. And I think that kind of writing can inadvertently sort of numb us to what a profound transformation we are living through. And so as I wrote Rising, the thing that most changed me was sitting in a stranger's living room and listening to them describe the moment, you know, the water works up the driveway and under the door, the sinking knowledge that they're going to have to, you know, redo all of the flooring in their home. And many people experience one flood and then they experience a second and a third. As I wrote Rising, I wanted to bring that lived experience into this discussion. I wanted to move away from the scientific discourse. I wanted to put the lived experience front and center with the hope of sort of touching people's hearts around this issue, not just their intellect.
In the New York Times review of your book, it said, "This is a book for those who mourn the changing climate." I mean, what do you make of characterizing your work as sort of an elegy?
I think it's one part elegy, but I also think that my work is one part radical resilience. It's true that I mourn the loss of species, the loss of language to talk about some of the plants and animals that have long resided along the water's edge. But I also found great hope, especially in a place like Oakwood Beach, Staten Island, where you had 9 different low-lying, lower-income, largely right-leaning communities say after Sandy, "We don't feel safe living here anymore. And we want this land to return to nature so it can act as a buffer in the storms to come." These are people who I would not have thought of as being some of the most progressive climate activists in this country. And here they were. They were willing to move away from their houses so that their sacrifice might benefit those around them and those in surrounding communities, and that the land would sort of be held as a commons for all. I find that really deeply hopeful.
Elizabeth Rush, she teaches creative nonfiction at Brown University. She's also taught at Southern New Hampshire University, and she's currently the 2019 Antarctic Artist and Writer in Residence for the National Science Foundation. Her book is titled Rising: Dispatches from the New American Shore. Elizabeth, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.